The cast of characters in the Formula One paddock is constantly changing. At almost every race, I see new people arriving and others moving on. But there are some constants, people who've seemingly always been there.
A new Formula One season begins on the high veld at Kyalami in South Africa. It's all changed for 1993. Alain Prost in pole position, with Ayrton Senna alongside him on the front row. Michael Schumacher and Damon Hill, row two. Jean Lacy in the lead Ferrari with JJ Leto debuting the Sauber. There's Ricardo Patrese and Mark Blundell in the lead.
That rainy day in South Africa was Beyat Zender's first weekend working in Formula One. The 2022 Hungarian Grand Prix was his 538th race, and he's always worked for the same team. Beyat is in his 30th season with F1's Swiss squad. It now says Alfa Romeo on his uniform, but for years, it said Sauber.
We knew that we have to deliver, and Peter Sauber always motivated us and said, listen guys, you were fantastic, we were fantastic in Group C, and there is no reason why we can't be good in F1.
Sensational bit of passing there by Kimi Raikkonen, the Finn in the Sauber.
Kimi was exceptional, and the way he looked at you, you had the feeling that if you give him a chance, he's taking it and he makes the best out of it.
Charles Leclerc does finish in the points for the first time ever.
Probably the most complete driver I've worked with in terms of natural talent. He's going to be a world champion.
I'm Tom Clarkson, and Beyat's perspective is one of the most fascinating we've ever had on F1 Beyond the Grid. He began as a mechanic on Sauber Mercedes sports cars, driven by, among others, a young Michael Schumacher. When the team entered Formula One in 1993, it was tiny. It was legendary owner Peter Sauber, Beyat, and just 25 others, including the two drivers. It's grown to 520 people today, and as sporting director, Beyat oversees them all. He reveals so much in this interview, amazing insights into how an F1 team really works, and even why some drivers made it and some didn't. And he's got so many illuminating stories to tell. Sauber's astonishing debut season, a difficult, dark second year in 1994, partnerships with Mercedes, BMW and Red Bull. He was there when Charles Leclerc, Sebastian Vettel and Kimi Raikkonen made their F1 debuts with Sauber, and he's helped the team win races on and off track. We started by talking about his route to a career in motorsport, which was very unusual.
I was never interested in racing in motorsport at all before I joined Sauber. So it was pure coincidence that I met with Peter for an interview, and after 10 minutes he said, no way, you're too young, you're inexperienced, and the worst of all, you don't even have an interest in motorsport. And so he kicked me out from the interview, and then 3 weeks later kept on bothering me. I called him again anyway, and then he hired me just because he needed a mechanic. He desperately needed someone building a Group C car. At the time, we had 8 people in total, 8 FTE. So it was Peter Sauber, Leo Rees, a secretary, the chief mechanic, and 3 other mechanics. And I was the 9th person who joined. And then we agreed on a 1-year term. And quite soon, it wasn't, especially the beginning of the time, it was not racing, because I didn't go to races till the first 2 months. I never went to a Formula One race and never had the knowledge about racing at all. But it was teamwork. And this was exceptional. We had like little bets in the company. We were, half of the week, we were sleeping in the company. Mrs. Sauber, Christiane, she brought dinner often, regularly, lunch and dinner. So we cleaned the working places, and she put a cover on top of it, and she served some soup and spaghetti. And literally it was teamwork, because you had to, with a very limited amount of people, we had to maintain one car and to build another Group C car from scratch.
But I need to take you back. So this first interview that you had with Peter Sauber, you were what, 21?
21, yes. I was in 87.
And you had no interest in motorsport, you say. So why did you go to the interview, if I might ask?
I was working as a mechanic in Sulzer Winterthur, which was the producer of the biggest and the best engines, diesel engines for ships, for big ships. So an engine would be like 30 meters in height, 12 meter in length. And when I was just finished my education, the plan was that I go to work on these diesel engines for good, and then travel with a group of engines, because every set of engines had a guarantee engineer or a guarantee mechanic with it. And you traveled on a boat. If you were lucky, it was a luxury liner. If you were unlucky, it was a freighter. So you traveled with the set of engines for a year. And this was my goal. This was what I wanted to do. And then they stopped production in Switzerland, because they figured that it's quite a bit cheaper to build engines closer to a sea, and then just have a big crane and just put it into the ships, then shipping it from Switzerland. And so all of a sudden, my dream job was gone. And I didn't want to move to Korea, because it would have been the next option, to Mokpo, actually. And I went to go to work in the morning by train. Normally, I went by bike. I was an extreme biker. I went, whatever weather, I went always by bike to go to work. And so one morning, my tire was flat. I went by train. I had a local newspaper, just like going through, and then I see PP Sauber AG is looking for race mechanic. And like you have to be willing to travel the world. And I thought, oh, this is what I want to do anyway with the ships. And so I applied for a job. I called and said, listen, I'm interested. And I got an interview date immediately, because I said he was desperately looking for a mechanic.
And you had never watched a motor race?
The only thing which came to my mind concerning motor race was, unfortunately, the accident of Gilles Villeneuve. And the ironic thing was that the driver he had contact with was then my very first Group C driver.
What impact did Peter Sauber make on you as a 21-year-old?
Oh, he's a leader. I mean, you had Sauber means clean in English. And so everything had to be clean. And he was very organized, very orderly. And the good thing was I was it myself. I was an athlete, I was a biker, I had my routines, I was training like hell. And it was a good match. But then Peter, at the beginning, he was working on the car, he was welding suspension, he was welding fuel rigs. So he was part of the team. And this changed then, obviously, quite soon after I joined, because then we've been the official works team for Mercedes, Sauber Mercedes in 88.
And there was something impossibly glamorous about those Silver Arrow sports cars, wasn't there? Did you feel that?
No, not at the beginning, because the first year we had the AEG, it was a blue car, and we painted it silver for in 89. By then, I knew a little bit about the history of Mercedes, about going to Le Mans in 88. We had to withdraw because we had a problem with the tires with our car. So one of our cars, both rear tires exploded on the straight in training, in practice session. So we withdrawn. And over the time, I learned about the history of sports car. I learned about the history of Mercedes, the tragic accident in the 50s, and the legacy of Mercedes as a Silver Arrow.
And of course, part of that Mercedes sports car program was the Young Driver program. And I'm thinking Heinz Harald Frentzen, Carl Wendlinger, Michael Schumacher. I guess you were a similar age to those guys at the time.
Pretty much. Heinz is, I think, a year younger than me, Carl as well, and Michael 3 years. You know, it's. I've been asked quite often how was Michael at the time. And to be honest, I can't remember. I remember some of the stories. His very first Group C test in Paul Ricard, he crashed into a Porsche, and then the Porsche driver came like pretty angry to Michael and said, "Why did you do it? You cut the corner." And Michael said, "Me? No. I didn't do it." But Michael's side of the car was pretty badly damaged, so, and still he denied. No, but we had a very good relationship. Sport was different then. It was more, still professional, but more relaxed. And obviously, we only had like 8 to 10 races in a season.
What was at stake for those three guys?
We had a clear plan about bringing them into Formula One.
Right. Mercedes had this plan.
Yeah, all three of them. And what happened to Michael was pure luck. That he got a ride in Jordan in 91 because of Gasho. Anyway, and for Heinz, the plan was that Heinz is going into Formula One with the with the Camel support. But then Michael had a chance to drive for Eddie Jordan, and then all the Camel money went from Heinz, from the planned money from the Heinz project to Michael.
That was the promotion to Formula One. But when they were just doing the sports car program, just tell me a little bit about their relationships. And I've got to ask it, who was quickest out of the three of them back then?
I would say by talent, it was Heinz. Heinz, by natural talent, it was Heinz. Carl was very quick as well. And then obviously the hardest work was Michael. He was the one who was, he's just like, he's living motorsport. There was no other theme other than setup and training, and he was completely focused. And Heinz departed in the middle of the season, 91. He went to Japan because he realized that the F1 dream is probably further away than he thought or than it was planned. When we gave him another chance in 93 to test a Formula One car, and this was Peter Sauber's present to Heinz. Although he left in the middle of the season, we were not too happy about it. No, and then when Heinz, the first chance in a Formula One car, he was excellent. He was really quick.
Is it a big disappointment to you that Michael never raced for Sauber in Formula One?
No. I think, probably... Not a lot of people know that he tested once a Sauber.
At Fiorano in 97, yeah, I've seen
tested
pictures.
Because the Ferrari wasn't really up to speed and he wanted to have a comparison with the Sauber car. No, I don't think it's a disappointment. I think we are all very proud that we had, you know, just a limited time together working on a project.
Do you look back at that period with great fondness?
Yeah, it were great times, really great times. And then you go to Le Mans. Okay, when Michael and Carl drove in Le Mans, we had a little disaster with a bracket on the engine on both cars. I mean, my car, I was number one mechanic. My car was leading with I think 3.5 laps ahead of the second runner, and on the other car, we had exactly the same problem. So a little bracket broke on the engine. And then the alternator belt would go off and the water pump wouldn't work anymore. We could repair it on Michael's car, but we couldn't repair it on Jean-Louis Schlesser's car. There the engine died on the straight.
When did you get the nod then that you were going Formula One racing?
This was actually in 91, and this is a little bit part of Sauber's history, that big car manufacturers from Germany are leaving us from one day to the next. The decision was taken, and it was a financial crisis in 91. The decision was taken by Mercedes-Benz that they're not supporting us anymore. And that's why we hired Harvey Postlethwaite, Mike Gascoigne, to work on the project. The plan was to have a year without racing in 92 and then join Formula One in 93. And then Mercedes withdrawn from all international sport activities. So the Group C program was ended, and they said we cannot commit to F1. And then it was up to Peter Sauber to make a decision. What are we doing? And we had some other offers, ideas from Mercedes, like a little bit of an AMG project, so designing and pimping up road cars for Mercedes. But Peter Sauber said that if we take the motorsport away from this team, it's like you take the ball away from a soccer team, and it's not working anymore. So it was his decision to enter F1, which was a high-risk decision. On the other hand, later, through his good connections with the CEO at the time at Mercedes, and we got financial support, Concept by Mercedes and Power by Mercedes.
How much pressure was there on the team as you went into 93?
The good thing on Peter was that he has got very wide shoulders. No, he's taken all the pressure. So for the team, we knew that we have to deliver. And Peter always motivated us and said, listen, guys, you were fantastic. We were fantastic in Group C. There is no reason why we can't be good in F1. And everyone else already in the business, the old shots like Ron Dennis would say that, yeah, of course, yeah, Group C, yeah, it's not the same level. And it wasn't the same level. But Peter took all the pressure, and sometimes you could feel it, you could see it on him. Quite often he was, especially beginning 93, he was nervous, not sure where we're going to. And then it went out perfectly. I mean, the first year was
end of lap one. Yeah. In your first Grand Prix, the Saubers were running fourth and fifth, weren't they?
Yeah, and we could have been on the podium with Karl Wendlinger, and we had an electronic issue. We had to change an ECU on Karl's car, and we lost about 3 minutes or so. So he could have been on the podium.
But you still finished fifth. We finished
with
JJ fifth
with JJ. This was exceptional. So we had this hotel, a very nice hotel close to the circuit, and in the evening it was with Mario Ilian, Peter Sauber, and we organized a party, and it was going we were very wild.
And how many people were there in the team at this moment? Because there were eight when you joined, what, 6 years before?
Yeah. The team size was about 150. But the team size, the number of people traveled to the event was 27. Including drivers, including physio, team principal. So the whole team was 27, and we had three cars and a spare chassis.
Of course, the spare car was a thing back then, wasn't it? And you were chief mechanic on whose car?
No, I was chief mechanic for both cars.
Both cars.
I was in 92. I was responsible for the preparation of F1. So all the needed equipment, like Gamozzi, for example, the car lifter. Obviously, in Group C, you had a little bit heavier cars. You had a different setting. You needed cranes to lift it on high stands in Formula One. Everything was a little bit different. So I was in 92. I visited eight races to see what's needed in terms of equipment, list of trolleys. But at the time, backdrops were not backdrops. It was like covers.
The team achieved 6 points finishes in 93 in an era when points only went down to sixth place. It was a phenomenal first season. Was there a danger inside the team that you guys were thinking this Formula One thing's quite easy?
No, it was never a danger, because we knew already from Group C. And Group C was it wasn't Formula One, but it was motorsport on a very high level. And we shall not forget that in the 90s, Group C was a little bit different than it is now. The WEC is now, because we had Nissan, Peugeot, Toyota, Porsche, Mercedes, Jaguar, Aston, Mazda. So we had big car brands. The competition was very tense, and you had to deliver in a professional manner. And so I don't think, just from the working approach on the car as a mechanic, as a chief mechanic, it wasn't so much different. Formula One cars were much simpler then. I would say Group C cars were much more complicated, because you had the lights, you had the wipers, you had flashers, whatever. No, it was never a risk that we lose ground.
But
never.
The reward was Mercedes coming in as the actual engine supplier for 94. You'd lured them back in.
Yeah.
And
it was them that was powered by Mercedes. It was Dylan Ilmor, obviously, Mario Ilian.
Did you feel that Mercedes were coming on board?
But it didn't last very long.
No. Well, that's it. I mean, how much of a disappointment was it when they went to McLaren
very,
for 95?
It was a huge disappointment, especially for Peter Sauber, because of the connection. And we brought Mercedes back into the sport, into motorsport, after Le Mans, into international motorsport. So basically, it was us who relived the Silver Arrow. Of course, with the support of Mercedes. No, it was a huge disappointment, and especially for Peter. And the time for us to react to find a new engine supplier was very short.
If you're finding yourself a bit stuck when it comes to your skincare routine, suffering more ingrown hairs, breakouts, or flaky skin, Harry's skincare range could be just the remedy you need. Harry's know that getting the smoothest, cleanest shave possible starts with your skin, and cleansing and gently exfoliating before you shave is the best way to achieve that. Their signature face wash is the perfect addition to a Harry's shave plan. And if you're keen to see what a difference it can make, Beyond the Grid listeners can get hold of a free travel size face wash by redeeming a free Harry's trial set at harrys.com/grid. All you cover is £3.95 for delivery. The face wash is non-drying, and its blend of peppermint and eucalyptus is so refreshing in the mornings. I like to use it daily to keep my skin in top condition between shaves, and it's an added bonus to know that all their products are alcohol and cruelty-free. In the trial set, you'll get an expertly engineered weighted handle, To help give you more control over your shave, a 5-blade cartridge complete with precision trimmer to tackle those tricky corners, a travel blade cover, and a wonderfully luxuriously foaming shave gel. And don't forget to try that freebie face wash. Make sure you support the podcast and start your own skincare journey by redeeming a free Harry's trial set. Just head to harrys.com/grid. That's harrys.com/grid. All you cover is £3.95 for delivery, and your freebie will be added at checkout. Sauber and Bayat's debut season in Formula One exceeded expectations. The second year was more challenging. It was darkened by a severe crash for their driver Karl Wendlinger in Monaco. That was just 2 weeks after the tragic San Marino Grand Prix at Imola. Roland Ratzenberger and Ayrton Senna lost their lives, and JJ Lehto, the driver who'd scored points for Sauber in their very first race, was caught up in a crash on the start line. That dreadful weekend shook Formula One and Bayat to the core.
I was really about to give up. I said, this is not my world. I cannot stand it. And because I knew Roland Ratzenberger from Group C, not very well, but I knew him as a driver from Group C. Then we had the star crash with JJ and Pedro, I think it was, and several spectators injured. Then we had Ayrton, then the miscommunication or the wrong communication that, yeah, he's in hospital, but they can talk to him. And this was just like, for me, it was too much. And then what the worst thing for me actually was the accident in the pit lane, when I think it was a Minardi who lost the wheel, and the wheel went like a bullet through mechanics. And no one would think of stopping the race. So the ambulance, they didn't let an ambulance into the pit lane. So with the stretcher, they dragged one mechanic after the other to the medical center, and they wouldn't stop the race. And for me, this was just like not real. Just because they are mechanics, we're not stopping, we're not suspending the race, and send some ambulances in the pit lane. So for me, this was horror.
Why did you continue?
Because Peter wouldn't give up. He's gone through different, through other times in motorsport, you know, beginning in mid-60s, end of the 60s. And he said, you know, this was like, it's not an excuse or an explanation, but it was just regular that the driver got killed every year, or at least one. And so he said, listen, this is part of our world. It is a risky sport, and it's the first time you experience something like this. Anyway, we had a long chat, and he kept me in the motorsport.
But Bayat, when Karl Wendlinger then has his horrific accident at Monaco, what were you thinking then?
It was for me even more horror, because at the time we had the garages where we worked on the car were on a different place than the pit lane. So for me, it was clear that I had to organize that Carl's car, and I had no idea about his status, that Carl's car is being brought into the pit lane and not into the garage, because if it was in the garage, there was no way to bring it for the second practice session. So I was running to turn 10 to the chicane, and when I arrived, I saw Carl laying next to the car and shaking, and I had a chat with Sid. And I said, Sid, what's going on? And they said, yeah, it doesn't look good. And then he was transferred first to the Monaco hospital, then to Nice. And it was a shock. It was a shock for the whole team. It was completely surreal. We've been on Thursday evening. We packed up. We had to. I was interviewed with the police for 1.5 hours about how we maintained the car. And they confiscated the car for a couple of weeks until. It was clear, and we could prove it already on the day, that it was just a little bit too late, a little bit. I think it was 27 meters too late on braking. No, it was very hard. And then the time after, because he was 19 days in hospital, unconscious, in coma, and for 19 days we didn't know whether he's going to survive or not. And this was because Carl was a very good friend, or is still a very good friend. No, it was very tough.
And can you remember how you felt when you got the news that he was out of the coma?
Yes, a big relief. And we've been, Urs Kuratli, the chief mechanic, and myself, next to Peter, we've been the first people to visit him. But this was like weeks later in Innsbruck. Then he was transferred to Innsbruck to emergency care. And then we've been the first people to visit him. And it was a big relief seeing him in one piece and in good mood, because when we went up to the floor he was in, we walked to his room and he came out of the room and he just walked past us because and then we said, Jesus Christ, he doesn't remember us anymore, because we knew that he had some when he woke up he thought that he's like 8 years old going for the next kart race, and then he was in half coma again, and then the next time he woke up he thought he's going to be in Hockenheim for a Formula 3 race, so he had like flashbacks. And so when we first saw him, he walked past and then we said, Jesus Christ, he doesn't know who we are. And then he turned around and said, gotcha. It's always tough, especially if it is one of your driver who is involved in an accident. But it's obviously you feel with all the teams, with families, if a driver is getting hurt.
And you must have been at Paul Ricard in October when he got behind the wheel of a Formula One car again.
Yep.
Was he straight back on it? I think the weather was wet.
No, it was. Actually, we had two tests. One was in Paul Ricard and the next one was in Barcelona. And Barcelona at the time had, with the old tarmac, they had like these very little bumps. And then all of a sudden he said, it's not good, I see double. We had to replace him for Japan. And his initial replacement, Andrea De Cesaris, he was so disappointed that we said that Carl is doing the last two events of the season. And when Peter Sauber called him and said, listen, Andrea, could you come to Japan? And then he said, no way, I'm in Malibu surfing. And then we brought JJ back for Japan. And JJ did one corner in the race and then he was out. No, and then Carl did Adelaide. I think it was Adelaide, but he had a crash on Saturday, if I remember right. And we took him out of the race on Sunday.
The crash aside, did you see the same old driver?
No, he changed quite a bit. Carl was always one of the most reserved driver. Carl would only talk to the people he knew. And a lot of mechanics, they complained that he's not saying hello in the morning. But he was a very shy person. And after the accident, he opened up completely. He started talking to everyone. So he changed, but for the good.
Sauber became the first team to run the high cockpit side.
We had huge problems because FIA wouldn't let us run initially. They said there's no way. It's not in the regulation. The template wouldn't fit in. And there was a huge fight, and Peter Sauber said, if we're not running them, we withdraw from the season. For us, it's a safety thing. And we're 100% sure that with the high cockpit side, Carl's accident would have been completely different.
What does it say about your team that you fought for safety in that way?
Oh, it was necessary. It wasn't. This was the time when I think F1 woke up, but obviously with two drivers killed like 2 weeks before Carl's accident, and then we had in Barcelona there was I can't remember who it was, Montaigne probably, with his legs out of the chassis, and so we had like three weekends in a row which were like very special and very dramatic, and showed us that there has to be that the safety side of the car have to be improved. And because of the side impact and Carl's helmet like being banged to the arm coats, and at the time, and for listener who don't know cars at the time, I mean the cockpit wall was at the shoulder, so the helmet was completely free in the air, and we pushed for it, and Peter it was very clear we have to do something.
And very satisfying for him that it was eventually mandatory.
Introduced, yeah.
Now let's bring it forward to 1995 and totally different track now. I'd like to ask you about Red Bull. They came on board as a sponsor in 95. How important was that deal to the team?
It was very important because we've been drinking Red Bull like day and night. No, it was not only Red Bull, it was Petronas as well. And I think Petronas joined in 94, halfway through the season, and then Red Bull, and we had, I mean, probably now the two biggest sponsors in F1, or amongst the two biggest sponsors, and they both started with us, and it was a fantastic time for both of us, for Red Bull and for Saab. First of all, with Red Bull, we had the financial background to do proper motorsport, And for Red Bull, it was just like a story of success. I mean, Red Bull was founded in 86, I think. And then in the first, I don't know how many years, Red Bull was only available in Austria and in Hungary. And with the worldwide sponsorship partnership with us, Red Bull was noticed. And step by step, I mean, we had, for example, Red Bull wasn't available in France, but was in Spain. And we had to pay 2,500 Swiss francs fine at the French border because the French said you're gonna smuggle Red Bull into France, and you know, things like that. So it was a young company, it was a very dynamic company. We had very close contact to Didi Mateschitz. He came quite often to races. I best memories with Didi.
You said a moment ago that you were drinking a lot of Red Bull, implying that it was lots of late nights. How different was the sport back then in terms of, I mean, an all-nighter was a regular occurrence back then?
Times have changed, and looking back at the time, we had three cars, we had four mechanics per car, and the mechanics, they did the bodywork and they did the refueling and they did everything. The all-nighters were just like on a regular basis. So like every other weekend, you had at least one night working through because you had a problem with the fuel cell. You had to, and you know, changing a fuel cell at the time, it was not an easy thing. And we had quite often, we just went back to the hotel for a shower and straight to work the other morning. And so this is, the amount of work and the intensity of days was much, much different than today, much, much harder. The team size was much smaller, but the team spirit was better because, you know, you had to rely on each other. You had one engineer, one race engineer, and you had a guy, now he's calling performance engineer, was the data engineer. And this was the number of engineers we had on the car. And then obviously you had an engine engineer, but one engineer for both cars. And now you've got literally for every piece on the car, you've got an engineer, either at the circuit or at home. But this is what the sport demands. This is how the sport developed. This is where we are now. But the team spirit at the circuit and at home, because the overall size of the team, 95 was probably 180, was different. You knew every person in the company. And now, for me, it's impossible to know every of our 520.
And by this time, you were team manager, weren't you?
Halfway through the season, 94, Peter Sauber, this was in Silverstone. I remember it very well because I was drunk.
That's the only reason you accepted the job.
No, it was, you know, when we had the parties behind the old paddock in Silverstone, there was a grass pit. Peter Sauber, he was looking for me for hours. He clapped me on the shoulder and said, "We have a meeting tomorrow." I said, And then the next day he said, "We separated from our team manager and our new, you're going to be her replacement. You're going to be our new team manager." I said, no way. I've never booked a hotel room or a flight for myself. And he said, no, you have to do it. And I said, give me 24 hours. After 24 hours, I said, no way, I'm not going to do it. I'm a mechanic, I stay as a mechanic. And then he said, okay, then the other choice is another person we had in the company. And said, yeah, but this person doesn't speak English at all. And all the driver's briefing, all the meetings are in English. So how? And then he said, see, it's got to be you. And then I agreed. And this was after Silverstone. I was in the end of 94, I was in the morning from 7 o'clock in the morning till 7 o'clock in the evening. I was in the workshop taking care of the cars. And then I went up to the top floor trying to organize the team. And really, I had never booked a room for myself. And all of a sudden, I had to do it for the team. And the lady before, she tried to destroy a lot of files and a lot of information. For some races, had no clue whether we have hotel rooms booked, the number of booked, where they were. So I had to figure out everything. Then we went to Hockenheim, and then the Deutsche Post, which were giving the radio license, came to me and said, where is the team manager? And said, it's me. And said, okay, come with us. And said, you have not applied for license, radio frequency license. So you're not allowed to have any frequency running on the weekend. And I said, but the radio communication, no. Telemetry, no, just like nothing. And then the shock was big. In the end, we paid, I think, 15,000 Deutschmark fine for not applying for license, but in the end, we sorted it out.
One final thing on Red Bull. Was there ever a chance that Sauber could have become Red Bull Racing?
I think so, yes. the whole project fell a little bit apart with Kimi and Enrique Bernoldi, because Red Bull was pushing for Enrique. Enrique was in Formula 3000 in the year 2000, and Peter Sauber asked me to follow him throughout the whole season. And I was sitting on the pit wall every race, every Formula 3000 race. And I wasn't really sure about his motivation. Why did he want to be a Formula One driver? Was it because he wanted to have free entrance in the biggest clubs? This was a little bit my feeling. And then for whatever reason, Peter Sauber gave Kimi a chance to test. And we still cannot recap or explain why he did it, because normally you're being approached by driver managers saying that we've got the biggest talent in the next decade on the contract, so give him a chance. And then when we took the decision that we're going for Kimi instead of Enrique, I think this is where the whole idea of being Red Bull Racing ended, because this was when Didi, who were main shareholder of the company, withdrawn from the company and sold his shares to Credit Suisse.
Right. It's interesting you mention Kimi, because I'd love to talk about 2001, your most successful season as an independent team, finished fourth in the World Constructors' Championship. Who alerted you, or Peter Sauber, to Kimi Räikkönen?
The Robertson, Dave and Steve. They went, and then Peter, about Dave, Peter is always saying this is a carpet dealer. It's not like you're going and you're bargaining about things. No, it was, and still, if you ask Peter now, there is no explanation why he gave Kimi a chance to test. And Mika Salo helped a little bit as well. Mika Salo, we knew after the summer break that he's going to join Toyota and he's going to leave. And he had a chat with Peter Sauber as well. So it was the Robertsons, and then Kimi tested in September, Mugello.
And you were there. How impressive was he?
Not very from his physics, but what would you expect from a driver coming from Formula Renault? So what we've done with him, we did like 3-4 laps, and then he needed a break for 15-20 minutes, and Joseph Leber was there treating him, his neck, to give him a chance to do as many laps as possible and sensible over the two-day period. And I wasn't, there is a story that Michael came and said, and who is this driver and you have to sign him. I wasn't there when, if the story is right or not, I don't know. Peter had a chat with Michael. But he was up to speed from beginning. No, it was comparable with Dini's. He was exceptional, and his comments, he didn't talk a lot then. No, his comments was, I can do better. No, he was impressive, and the way he looked at you, and you had the feeling that he if you give him a chance, he's taking it and he makes the best out of it.
Sensational bit of passing there by Kimi Räikkönen, the Finn. He's only 21 years old. There he is in the Sauber. Sauber, a great job with their drivers in the points, fourth in the Constructors' Championship.
So, Bayer, how much of a surprise was fourth and sixth in Melbourne?
The whole year was a surprise, and the whole year was evolved in something completely unexpected. We had a lot of good races. The car was excellent, and then you had two drivers who were pushing each other. I mean, Nick a little bit upset that he didn't get the McLaren drive. The year before he was with Prost, and before he was for McLaren in Formula 3000. But they were pushing each other, and we had a very good time together.
Did you regret letting Kimi go at the end of the year?
We didn't let him go. We had to let him go. I think if you ask Kimi, there was no option. He made it very clear. We had a bulletproof 3-year contract with him, but he made it very clear that he's rather going to stop than carry on. Either he's going to join McLaren or he's going to stop. He made it very clear.
And there was a certain financial incentive as well.
There was with the financial. I don't know how much it was, but with the financial incentive, we started building our wind tunnel,
which is still operating today.
It's still one of the state of the art.
When you stop and think about how much of your time is spent on the internet, whether for work or personal affairs, it can be shocking to think that every site you visit, video you watch, or message you send is at the risk of being tracked and data mined. Big tech is more powerful than most countries, and they profit by exploiting your personal data. When you consider that a single company controls 90% of internet searches, runs your email service, and can track everything you do on your smartphone, it makes sense to ensure you put a layer of protection between your online activity and these tech juggernauts. And that's where ExpressVPN can help. When you run ExpressVPN on your device, the software hides your IP address, which big tech can use to identify you, and this makes your activity harder to trace and sell to advertisers. ExpressVPN encrypts 100% of your internet data to keep you safe from hackers, and it manages to do all of this without slowing down your connection. And what's really great is it's so easy to use and get started. Just download the app on your phone or computer, tap one button, and you're protected. So stop handing over your personal data to the big tech monopoly that mines your activity and sells your information. Protect yourself with the VPN I trust to keep me safe online. Visit expressvpn.com/grid. That's expressvpn.com/grid to get 3 extra months free. Go to expressvpn.com/grid right now to learn more. Time to talk more about drivers. We'll get on to Felipe Massa and Charles Leclerc shortly, and there's more to come about Kimi Raikkonen. But I asked Bayat about the other two world champions he's worked with. Jacques Villeneuve was the second, and Bayat's take on him might surprise you. The third champ is Sebastian Vettel, who drove the BMW Sauber in tests, in practice sessions at the end of 2006, and in his Grand Prix debut in 2007. Bayat was there for those early tests, and he remembers Seb struggling at first.
When we tested him in, I think it was Jerez, the first time I was sitting in our car, before he had a test with Williams, he was a slowie, so meaning that he needed quite a bit of time to adapt to changes, track changes, grip changes. We had, when it was a little bit damp and dried out, he was a very slow learner, and let's say the first couple of tests I wasn't so impressed about him, but then he opened, I don't know what he opened, but anyway, and we gave him the first P1 session in Istanbul, and he put it on with the quickest time. Of course, it was low fuel level and the super or the extreme soft or whatever we had, but still you had to do it. You had to set the time, and he developed himself during the practice session, during all test sessions, massively. Again, if you look at his very first, his first complete season, 2008, I mean, there is a joke. We had almost a running gag that if there was a start accident, Sebastian was always nearby. So he was involved quite a bit. And then again, when after he won Monza, the world has changed for him. The level of confidence you get with a race win, I think, must be extreme.
Did you see similarities between Sebastian and a young Michael Schumacher in terms of work ethic, how they approached things?
Sebastian was a kid by then. Michael was 20 when he joined Sauber. Sebastian as well, but Michael was much more mature in his age than Sebastian was. Sebastian was really like a little kid. No, I didn't think of similarities of the two of them.
And the third world champion that's raced for Sauber, Jacques Villeneuve.
Yep.
2005, he did the whole season, half of 2006. The results didn't stand out, but what impressed you about him?
First of all, that we were able to sign a world champion. I mean, this was a thing at the time. This was a thing that Sauber is having a world champion on board. Then what I remember is the fuss around him. So his manager, his physio, they would say he needs like that much space in a driver room. He needs a couch. He needs this and that and that. And I told them, we're not building a team around the driver. The driver has to accept actually what he gets. And in Sauber, all the time, the driver has all been treated the same. And so when Felipe Massa, when he gets a driver room which is like 3x3 meters, Jacques will get the same. He will not get the 3x6 meter. And the fuss which his manager made around, he came to Melbourne and said, Jacques will never accept it. He will never accept such a small driver room. And I said, but this is what he gets, full stop. And he was absolutely no problem. He was easy to deal with. All the rumors about him being completely difficult, the prima ballerina, was absolutely not true. To work with him, it was great fun. We had a good time. We still have a good time together.
Who was quicker out of him and Felipe Massa?
In the end, it was Felipe. It was Felipe. Felipe, young, upcoming. We had some problems with Felipe as well because we kicked him out of the 2002. And then he came back in 2004 because 2002 was a disaster. He was a kid not willing to learn, to take advices on board. He left. He had to leave Sauber. 2003, he had a season with Ferrari alongside Michael, testing a lot. Then when he came back, he was a different person, a different driver, and he was quick. Felipe was quick and consistent. And Jacques, which was a little bit bizarre for me, he needed motivation. He needed someone to push him through a race. A race engineer telling him you have to push more, you have to break deeper into one. You still do coaching these days, but the amount of coaching we did with Jacques was very special.
That's very interesting, isn't it? Now, you've worked with so many drivers in your Sauber career, and I'm including sports cars. Difficult question coming now. Who was the fastest? Who has been the fastest?
Yeah, it was Kimi. From a talent point of view, from a pure talent point of view, it's definitely Kimi. And now everyone is saying, or a lot of people are saying, that if he would have taken it more serious, he could have achieved more world championship title. But I think what happened to him in 2003 and 2005, I think it was 2003 and 2005, when he lost out by 1 point, and this was, he had too many DNFs, technical problem on the car. He should be a three-time world champion, definitely. So from a pure talent, this is Kimi.
Had Kimi lost any of his speed from 2001 to when he came back to the team in 2019?
I think what he lost is his qualifying speed, because he was one of the quickest qualifier when he was young, and now he would probably disagree with me. I think it's a matter of age. In the age of 42, I think probably the quarters are arriving quicker than in the age of 20. No, he lost a little bit on his qualifying performance. In the race, he was still excellent. I mean, you don't talk to Kimi during the race. He does everything on his own. So when you have engineers talking in the background, engine settings, and okay, let's tell him he should go to engine 2, and then he just did it by himself. So he is one of the most, for me, one of the most clever racing driver. He can read races. He knows exactly when he has to defend, when he has to push, when it's better to let someone overtake, because he's on a different strategy. He reads. He wants to. The information Kimi wants to have during a race is what's going around him, what he doesn't see, and then he can read races.
There's one other driver I'd like to ask you about. Charles Leclerc, 2018. Comparisons between him and a young Vettel, a young Schumacher?
Very talented. He needed a little bit longer than expected. I think the first point he scored here in Baku, if I'm not mistaken. Until that race, he struggled because the driving style needed for a Formula 1 car was a little bit different than the F2. All of us, we expected for him to adapt a little bit quicker. I think he expected it from himself as well. But in the end, bottom line, probably the most complete driver I've worked with in terms of natural talent, in terms of intelligence, race intelligence, and then just like he's so focused, and he's going to be a world champion.
Can I ask you now about a case of what might have been? And I'm talking about the BMW era. They bought the team in 2005. Surely the team could have become world champion as a BMW-owned enterprise.
I think this was clearly the goal. And it went, we were heading in the right direction, especially 2008. Although pre-season test wasn't as bad as this year, but it was bad as well. And we had kind of a B version at the first race. And the amount of the manpower and the financial investment which we had at the time was just like excellent. And so we were one of the top teams. Unfortunately, we made like a concept mistake with the curse. In 2009, I think we've been the only team with an air-cooled system instead of a fluid-cooled. And we could run 50% throughout the whole season on the electric engine, not more, because it was overheating all the time. And so it was a terrible season, 2009 after 2008. But I'm pretty sure that if BMW would have stayed on board, we would have been world champion sooner or later, definitely.
Now, even today, Robert Kubica will tell you that he could have won the world championship in 2008. He won the team's only race, actually, so far, in Montreal. And he said that was the moment to kick on and win that world championship, but the management said otherwise.
No, I think the focus was probably too early put on 2009 with the new engine formula, with the new electric part. Probably he was right that we should have invested more towards the end of the season in 2008 in the current year. But on the other hand, and now Robert would disagree as well, the win actually was Nick's win in Montreal. Nick had to let Robert go because we were on different strategy, fuel strategy. But if Nick would have blocked Robert a couple of laps, I think Nick could have won the race. So it was a team decision.
Well, I'm looking forward to your next meeting with Robert Kubica.
No, he knows.
But Bayat, I must say, though, it was wonderful to see Robert win that race after his horrific accident at the same track the previous year.
Absolutely, it was. It's always great to win a Formula One race, because we only won one race. It was a very exceptional weekend, especially because it was a 1-2. And with Robert, we measured the highest heart rate ever in a Formula One driver. It was above 200. But this was when he stepped on the top podium, not driving, when he was on the top of the podium. It was really good. I had to organize a party in the evening, a short notice party. I had to find a restaurant for 100 people, and it was very good.
Happy days. Less happy days, of course, is when BMW pulled out at the end of 2009. They weren't the only ones to pull out that year, of course. But how much warning did you get?
No, zero. But not even Mario Tyson was informed. It was in June or July, I think, when they announced it. But Peter Sauber and Mario Tyson was informed the day before the announcement. The guy who was behind the F1 project was Dr. Panke, the CEO. And then it was the CEO, he retired. And then it was Mr. Reithofer. And we had another financial crisis. F1 wasn't so popular. We had other incidents with the president of the FIA and things. I think Dr. Reithofer was more like interested in horses and golf. And so I think they shifted the focus. But I cannot tell for sure. But there was zero warning. Then we had a difficult time because we had a company interested. Then when it turned out that it's not real, then we had another problem. We didn't get a license from the FIA because the license was given to US Grand Prix. And FIA, they assessed the US Grand Prix company and they came back and said it's legit and they have the personnel and they have the machineries and they have everything. But in the end, nothing was there, just a little bit. And we had to fight for, first of all, to keep the company alive. Peter Sauber bought the company back.
How close did you come to going under?
Oh, it was very close. It was extremely close.
Without Peter stepping in and buying shares back?
At the time when the company was sold to BMW, 67% of the shares were Credit Suisse, 33% were Peter. And the deal was that Credit Suisse keeps on stickers, logos on the car, and then step over the 4 years, they turn over the shares to BMW. So in the end, the bluntly saying that Peter Sauber, with the 33%, the revenue he's got from the 33%, with the 33%, he had to buy 100% of the company back. It wasn't cheap because meanwhile, BMW invested a lot in the facilities. We almost doubled the working space in the time. And it was extremely difficult. First of all, to convince BMW for a deal. But there I wasn't involved at all. So this was Peter and Monisha. And then to get the license from the FIA. And I think till January we didn't have a license. So even though the company was kind of safe, we couldn't compete because there was no license. And then this was one of the hardest time for Peter and for me as well. We had to let go 250 people. We had almost cut the size of the company in half. And this was hard because you had, you know, mechanics which were there for years and years and years, and you know their families, and you have to tell them, sorry, there is no space for you anymore.
How much help was Bernie Eccleston through all this?
I don't know. I was not involved in that. No, it was the first year when, if you look at the car, 2010, there was Bridgestone, I think pretty much the only sticker on the car at the time, because we had to do it contractually. But it was a plain car, no logos. So someone must have helped.
Do you think Bernie liked Sauber full stop? Do you think he liked the fact that there was a Swiss team in Formula One?
At the beginning, I'm pretty sure that he didn't think that we're going to survive for a long time. And you know, in the 90s, you had so many Formula One team coming and going. Andrea Moda, then later Pacific. But in the end, I'm sure that he appreciated Peter on a personal level, and that we achieved what we have achieved.
If you were to map out the location of current Formula One factories, you'd notice a trend. 7 of the 10 are in the UK. Motorsport Valley is where you'll find Red Bull, Mercedes, Aston Martin, McLaren, Williams, even French team Alpine and US-owned Haas are there. 2 teams are in Italy, Ferrari and AlphaTauri, and then you have 1, based all on its own, in Switzerland. Hinwil is home to about 12,000 people and the Sauber F1 factory. It's now the base for Alfa Romeo. Hundreds of snow-covered mountains and hundreds of miles separate the team from the rest of the F1 world. Beat says the team's unique location is sometimes challenging, and not just because of the long journeys to racetracks.
Prize money is paid in US dollars. Let's say in the 90s, when you get 30 million US dollars, it was 45 million Swiss francs. And then the exchange rate changed completely. And now if you get $50 million, you got less than 45 million. So this was one of the points which made it very difficult to do motorsport out of Switzerland. And then salary level are extremely high in Switzerland. So you have to manage your money in a different way. It was not always easy to be attractive for English engineers. But then again, if you look, we have so many engineers, UK citizens, which are working for us for 20 years, 20, 15 years.
But you know what they describe Sauber as? They describe it as a trap. I've talked to the guy. They say you come to Switzerland and you never leave.
Yeah,
because it's such a beautiful place.
You have two types. Either you leave quite soon because you Swiss people are very reserved. You're not just like invite people to your house, which you don't really know. So it's very reserved. And either you're if you're not getting connected, especially if you're moving to Switzerland with your family, with your children. Children normally they don't have problem to get connected, but if a wife doesn't get connected, if she doesn't find anyone, then you have the two groups. So one group is leaving within a year or two because they don't like it. But most of the guys, the English guys, who joined Sauber, they're still with us.
It's a trap.
because the fondue is so good.
Of course, Peter Sauber, he buys the shares back, but then he does eventually sell to Longbow Finance in 2017. Do you think it was a wrench for him to sell? How much does he miss it?
He had to sell. It's quite simple. He had to sell. We had some very dark years in terms of financial situation. The biggest problem was changing from a V8 to a V6. The V8 was probably 3 times cheaper in leasing fees than the V6. And this was like, if we're talking about 12, 13 million a year difference, and as a small team, as a private team, it was just impossible to recover it with sponsors. And this is when our huge, the bigger problem started. Leasing fee for the engine, for the gearbox was so exorbitant.
What this highlights is just how many different areas you are having to deal with on a daily basis, Ben.
Yeah, probably more than other of my colleagues, but this is normally if you grow up in a company, probably you have more jobs than other people. I'm taking care of the infrastructure, garage infrastructure, of trucks, of hospitality, of catering, of historical cars, the driver academy. And last but least, a little bit of sporting regulations.
Just the sporting regulations. I know you had a very close relationship with Charlie Whiting at the FIA, didn't you?
If you didn't have a good relationship with Charlie, it was definitely on you and not on Charlie. No, Charlie was... And the way the rules are written today is my regulation, basically. Not the wording, but the composition of the articles. And I went to Charlie, I think it was 2013, and said, Charlie, the whole structure doesn't make sense. We jump from race start to tire test to driver's briefing, and we should arrange it in a more logical order. And then he said, Beat, if you want to do it, go ahead. And I said, here it is. And then he went through it, and then I said, this is a fine piece of work, and congratulations. And then we adopted it.
Why have you remained true to Sauber all of these years? Because I'm sure there would have been offers to join other teams.
Yeah, I had a few offers, but the timing was never right. In 91, I had a car accident in Japan. I have no idea what happened, because I was in coma for quite a while. Anyway, I was sentenced to be guilty. And I was sentenced to pay the family a compensation, which was complete. And I was a mechanic, which was completely out of my reach. And I thought, if I'm going to pay $1 million compensation, then, you know, my life is basically done. Anyway, Peter Sauber and Mercedes-Benz helped a lot. I had 8 weeks house arrest in Kumamoto. And so Peter Sauber helped me. And then he gave me the chance, although I didn't want to do it, to develop myself as a team manager. And when the offers came from other teams, it was always a wrong moment. The first real offer came when BMW took over. Probably I can say, Didi called me immediately, Mateschitz, and I said, I want you to work for me. And I would never dare to ask Peter to let you go, but now Peter is gone, now it's BMW, come to me. And then it took me 3 months to decide, actually. No, and Peter said, Bert, we need you here for the transition, because without you, it's not going to work. And, so this was the first moment. And then later, with the financial difficulties we had, I always thought it would not be right to just run away. And I had some good offers, but it was never the right timing.
And is there an element now that you've been with the team so long, you can't see yourself anywhere else now?
No, I wouldn't say that. No, never say never. At the moment, I'm still happy, especially now with how the season goes. Of course, it is not that funny to work if you turn up on a race weekend and you say, if we're very lucky this weekend, we score a point. So the situation, the sporting side has changed completely, and this helps to motivate myself. But this helps the whole team. And this is a different mood in the garage than we had the last 2 years, because the last 2 years were really difficult in terms of on the sporting side. But I would not say never, but the right offer would have to come. Probably the next 1 or 2 years, because then it's definitely too late to change.
Well, it'll be interesting to see what happens, Beat. But when you look back at your time at Sauber so far, which do you think has been the happiest era for you?
Group C. Several elements. First of all, we've been a very, very small team, and we've been working day and night. And the friendship in the whole team, and it was not like colleagues, they were really friends. We, you know, stupid as we were, that if we had a free weekend, a free evening in a week, we went for dinner together. No, it was a bunch of crazy young people, and what we've done at the time, I mean, we welded wishbones ourselves. So we had like two half pieces, and we had to weld it. We builded a car, except the engine and the gearbox. The car was built by a bunch of people, and this was no carbon cockpit. It was aluminum, riveted, bolted, whatever, glued. It was exceptional. And then obviously winning Le Mans 89. For me, there is nothing bigger in motorsports, probably, because it's a long race, and it's not only 24 hours. It's you start on Saturday early morning, so it's more like 36 hours in total. And you hardly sleep the whole week. And then 2 times world champion in sports car. And these were, yeah, if you win races, it's always good. I love the sport. I love still teamwork. Sometimes you have a crash on a car and you look at it and you say, it's impossible. You cannot fix it till in the next 2 hours to start P2 or qualifying. And then if you manage your team right and you reallocate probably mechanics from one car to the other to help each other out, in the end it's teamwork, and this is what's still extremely fascinating.
Bayat is an extraordinary man who's had an extraordinary career in Formula One. So much history wrapped up in one person, and yet still so current and so passionate about the sport. Bayat, many thanks for your time. It was wonderful to debrief you on your career so far, and I'm sure you have many more races to come. Here's to the next 500. As ever, please send in your thoughts and stories about Bayat. Have you worked with him at Sauber? Can you relate to any of the stories he's mentioned in our conversation? Let me know, and I'll read out some of your messages at the end of our next show. Which, of course, brings me on to what you sent in about Mike Crack after last week. Even though Aston Martin is having a hard time on track, there's still a lot of love out there for the team. Let's start with this from Ette Keneal. What a great interview with Mike Crack. I've always believed Vettel's work ethic has been on a great level, raising his talent even further. And to hear Mike speak about my favourite driver, Sebastian, made me very happy. Vettel will be very missed on track and around the paddock with his inspirational actions, personality and great car control. When everything suits him, he is a beast on track. I hope one day I will meet this great driver in person. Well, Seb is all of those things you describe, Ette, and Mike is a brilliant boss who no doubt will lead Aston Martin to great things with or without Seb. Next, let's hear this from LD Bicchetti. Guys, I believe the 2024 Aston Martin will be fighting for the World Championship. Wow, LD, that's a big shout, and sooner than even the team expects to be doing that. Mike Crack will be pleased that you think this, though. Great stuff. And finally, let's give the floor to William Smith. I never knew that Mike and Andreas Seidel had worked so closely together in the past. BMW have such amazing pedigree in Formula One, and to think that they trained up so many senior people in the sport is extraordinary. Great insights from Mike. Thank you. Well, thanks for the note, William. And I loved Mike's story about him and Andreas meeting up at the back of the Bahrain grid earlier this year and discussing how far they'd come in their careers and how well their teams were doing. Well, not doing at the time, but certainly are going to be doing in the future. Well, we'll leave it there for this week and for a couple more weeks, because F1 Beyond the Grid is taking a 2-week summer break. We'll be back on Wednesday, the 24th of August, just before the Belgian Grand Prix, with another great guest from the world of Formula One. Until then, have a great summer and thanks for listening. F1 Beyond the Grid is produced by F1 and Audioboom Studios. Until next time, keep it flat out.